Our final faculty member is Dr. Tony Greco, who always also has a word to say about cancer of unknown primary. But to begin our conversation, Dr. Greco provided another perspective on the plenary paper on the management of older patients with advanced non-small cell carcinoma.
It's been debatable whether patients in this group should receive single agents versus combinations. It's been mixed results. And in Europe, the studies previously didn't show any advantage of two drugs versus one. This was a large European study that empirically used two drugs. With Taxol on a weekly schedule, it's easier to tolerate that way and probably is just as effective as shown in previous randomized studies compared to an every 3-week schedule with carboplatin or single agent alone. And that study clearly, although we need better therapy for this group of patients than either of these arms, it clearly showed superiority of the combination, and the toleration was pretty good, even though it was a little more toxic than the single agent arm. So I think it's clear that elderly patients, particularly when they don't have severe comorbidities, need to be treated like younger patients. Many of us have felt this way for years, but this sort of confirms it.
Can you remind me, I don't remember, what was the entry criteria? Was it a specific age?
Yes, 70 or greater was
70.
Yes.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right. Is there any sort of rule of thumb you have right now in terms of how you approach first-line therapy in general and how it differs, if any, in the patient who's over 70 or 75?
Well, I think in the elderly population where there's substantial comorbidities, and there are various scales where one can quantify the comorbidities, but when they're substantial, I think you have to be very careful. And that represents a large minority of patients, particularly over the age of 80. I'm still not convinced we ought to use combinations in many of those patients, but all the others, I think they should be viewed pretty much the same as patients, younger patients, in terms of the therapies. A general approach to advanced non-small cell lung cancer that I have is probably similar to many other oncologists. I think there's an important distinction now between squamous and non-squamous. I'm talking stage 3B and 4 patients now, and that there's enough data for me to treat non-squamous and squamous in a different fashion.
Can you kind of go through specifically what you do?
Yes, I think those that unequivocally have adeno or large cell carcinoma should be treated with pemetrexed combinations. The studies, the large study was unequivocally positive, used pemetrexed and cisplatinum. Again, I'm flexible with the platinums and often use carboplatin. So that forms the basis, with or without bevacizumab or Avastin, for combinations that I frequently use in general. Now, there are specific examples where I'll vary from that course, depending on molecular analysis and other issues.
And what about the squamous patients?
In the squamous group, and the base combination that I prefer right now is gemcitabine and carboplatin. And again, in selected patients, I would add cetuximab based on the phase 3 data.
And how do you select the patients who you are going to use an EGFR inhibitor? Do you use cetuximab or do you use panitumumab also?
Off study, I've used the panitumumab as well. I'm not sure there's any difference, although I don't know that we have adequate data yet to routinely substitute panitumumab for cetuximab in this setting.
Although you're in the reaction belt, though, aren't you?
Yes, and in this reaction belt, I'm much less likely to use either one of these compounds, although panitumumab doesn't have a hypersensitivity. I'm not overly impressed that you're gaining that much by using either one of these drugs in most patients.
So when you do use an EGFR antibody, you know, what kind of patient would you typically use it in?
Those who are particularly healthy. Again, not overwhelmed with a lot of tumor and a lot of other comorbidities.
Now, getting back to the older patient, really the one with comorbidities, when you use single agent therapy, what single agent do you generally utilize?
I like gemcitabine or weekly taxanes. I like them equally well in the setting of squamous. In non-squamous, I believe that pemetrexed or Alimta as a single agent makes a lot of sense for those where you feel single agents preferable.
I'm curious what your take is in terms of Mark Sosinski's presentation looking at nab-paclitaxel. You're talking about carbo-paclitaxel in this plenary session. What do you think about NAB, and do you see that, you know, moving in, and if so, in what situations?
Yes. So I recall that study had an unusual endpoint for a phase 3 trial. Response rate was the major comparative endpoint, and it was statistically higher response rate. I'm not sure that makes a difference overall for these patients, although certainly NAB paclitaxel seems to be easier to use and perhaps less neurotoxic.
Yeah, and my favorite question when I'm talking about breast cancer in terms of this particular topic is, how would you utilize NAB if it was the exact same cost and reimbursement as generic paclitaxel? And I'll ask you that same question in lung cancer.
I believe if it was the exact price, that I would substitute that agent for paclitaxel or Taxol.
That's what a lot of people say about breast cancer. So, you know, it's kind of get the feeling there's a marginal benefit, and people a lot of times don't want to take that step because of the economic implications. But is there anything that you've observed? I don't know how much you've used NAB either in lung cancer or breast cancer, just in terms of your gut feeling, in terms of what it brings to the table quality life-wise.
Yeah, we used it considerably in lung cancer early on, one of the first phase 2 trials. And it's easier to use. The hypersensitivity is not an issue. And I believe there's less neurotoxicity. So it does have some advantages. But when one considers the private practice cost issues and reimbursement issues, I'm not sure it's enough of an advantage for wholesale use yet.
There was another paper at ASCO that you were a part of. It was a randomized phase 2 looking at pemetrexed, gem, and bev, or pemetrexed, carboplatinum, and bev in elderly patients. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes. This, of course, was not a definitive phase 3 comparison, but nonetheless provocative and very interesting. And there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival and even survival in this phase 2 randomized trial in non-squamous patients, the elderly group favoring the carboplatinum pemetrexed arm. That was significant in that trial, both for PFS as well as overall survival, although it was a phase 2 study.
I guess that combination of pemetrexed, carbo, and bev is one I hear a lot of investigators talking about using, a lot of docs in practice. I guess we don't really have phase 3 data comparing it to other sort of bev combinations such as carbo-paclitaxel. Do you use that regimen? I guess based on what you said before, you use it a lot.
Yes, there's actually a phase 3 trial ongoing, which we're participating in, that looks at the pemetrexed carboplatinum bev versus Taxol carboplatinum and bev, the standard. So we'll have more information there. My own feeling is that in non-squamous patients that that's a friendlier, easier regimen. I can't imagine it being inferior to Taxol, carboplatinum, and bev.
A couple other papers you've had, I don't know if you want to comment on, I can't find too many people who know about it, which is vandetanib. And there was one at ASCO last year, and there was one at the ISLAC meeting that Ryan Natale was the lead author, but you were also on the paper. Can you talk a little bit about vandetanib, what we know about it, and what you all have seen?
Yes, it's an oral bifunctional TKI that had some promise, still has some in certain settings, but the study you're referring to is a phase 3 trial that compared it to erlotinib or Tarceva in second or third line therapy. And that trial didn't meet its pre-specified endpoints, but clearly it appears that vandetanib is as effective as Tarceva, but there's no real advantage, at least in that setting.
So where do you see things heading, if anywhere, with this agent?
Well, that's a good question. There appears to be some important activity in thyroid cancer and other neoplasms. It's not totally dead in lung cancer, in my opinion. There are several other studies that we don't have the final results on and follow up on. But in terms of comparing it to erlotinib in the setting of second, third line therapy, I doubt whether it goes any further.
All right, well, let's talk about your cases. Maybe we can start out with your 45-year-old woman.
Okay. She had some cough and has never smoked cigarettes, but was unfortunately was found to have a lung lesion, a left upper lobe. And pre-treatment staging was negative, and she had a left upper lobe lobectomy and unfortunately had some microscopic disease in her N2 mediastinal node. She had 10 removed, and so she was a resected stage 3 patient, 3A, and never smoked. And indeed, her EGFR was wild type. You might have predicted that she might have a mutation. I think an EML4ALK was also done in her, and it also was negative.
So how did you approach her treatment?
Well, I think there's no question she needs adjuvant therapy. And although the data is not definitive about radiation, I think she also needs that. So in these patients, I tend to use an induction course since it's proven adjuvant therapy in stage 3A patients is proven to improve survival. I'll use an induction course, and then I'll follow that up with radiotherapy. In this patient, that would be the way that I'm planning to go. She's relatively new, but she's already started on chemotherapy with pemetrexed and carboplatin.
And how is she tolerating it so far?
Very well.
No, I mean, she's 45 years old in particular. What about your choice of using carbo? A lot of investigators would be using cis.
I understand, and I use cis rarely, usually on studies where you have to and we're learning. When you look at the meta-analysis in patients, mainly with advanced disease, we don't have a lot of data in early stage disease. Really, there's no survival advantage of cis over carbo, and I just tend not to use the drug. The toxicity is a problem in some patients, not all. And sometimes you aren't able to get the drug in, which would be a major problem in the adjuvant setting. So I generally use carboplatinum when I have a choice of platinums.
Now, what would you have done if she had had an EGFR mutation?
I would have incorporated, again, without definitive data yet, although there's some interesting phase 2 data coming out of the Northeast, I would have incorporated erlotinib or Tarceva after her radiation therapy, probably for a year, maybe 2 years, certainly for a year.
Now, I'm not sure how you got the EML4 ALK done, but assuming she was EGFR wild type but EML4 ALK positive, are there any adjuvant trials out there that she could get into?
I'm not aware of one, and the testing is FISH testing, and there are a couple labs that are doing this now, but were involved in a study of this inhibitor, the same one that was presented at the plenary session, and we have to use a specific lab for that particular study, so that's an issue for the patients, particularly if it's at variance with what we got from another lab.
Any thoughts about the ECOG study in the adjuvant setting that's looking at chemotherapy plus or minus bevacizumab? And theoretically, this patient might have been eligible for that.
Yes, that's true. I hope that that study is positive. You know, it worries me a little because none of the targeted drugs in colorectal cancer have proven to be positive. Let's hope that's not predictive of what happens in non-small cell lung cancer. But I support that study, and we're not involved in it, but we have other adjuvant trials. But I believe that that's an important study.
Anything else you want to say about this patient?
Not really. I think she has a reasonable prognosis, given the fact that she had microscopic stage 3A disease. She's young and healthy, and will have an increased cure rate with the chemo and radiation. So I'm hopeful that she does well.
You mentioned, I should say, that I think you're probably in the minority in terms of, you know, considering erlotinib in the adjuvant setting in the patient with a mutation. What about your approach to patients in the first-line metastatic setting? We have the IPAS data out there right now looking at an EGFR TKI. In this case, it was gefitinib versus chemo. I find a lot of investigators have changed the way they're approaching first-line therapy, although I got a feeling you already changed before IPAS. But how do you approach it?
Well, I'm not sure that it makes a major difference if the patient receives erlotinib or a TKI initially or later after induction chemotherapy. Those questions haven't been answered yet. We have simultaneous result therapy recently reported at ASCO, which didn't show any difference in survival, which was pretty interesting. My own approach is I individualize. If a patient has a mutation and is not a good candidate for chemotherapy, then it's pretty easy. You go with erlotinib initially. If a patient, however, is quite healthy, I would probably use one of the induction approaches depending on their histology. Most of these are adenocarcinoma. But I would have the erlotinib on the back burner. I wouldn't use it concurrently. If, however, the patient, after discussions, didn't like the side effects of chemotherapy, and I would go over that differential there, I would be very willing to use erlotinib as first line based on the data we have.
How about your 52-year-old man?
He presented a few months back as well. This is interesting. He's been a heavy smoker and was found to have a single brain met. He presented with some headaches and had a right middle lobe lung mass. All his other staging was negative. His molecular studies, however, showed that he indeed had a mutation of the epidermal growth factor receptor, exon 19, which, again, smokers can develop these mutations too. There's a tendency to think you have to be a non-smoker, but non-smokers can get smokers' quote-unquote lung cancer, and smokers can get quote-unquote non-smokers' lung cancer. I'm not sure of his situation, but biologically, he has this mutation. And he's had the brain lesion resected, and he's not yet started on chemotherapy. He had a little trouble in the post-op course with pulmonary embolization, but he's better now, and he's home. And we'll be thinking about his induction chemotherapy and how we're going to incorporate erlotinib and whether we're going to remove the lung lesion since there are no other clinical known metastases.
So what are you thinking you might be doing?
I'm thinking that we'll probably use a pemetrexed combination in him. With the recent pulmonary emboli, I'm not sure I'm going to be using Avastin in him. Probably not. And then if he has a very good response and he's reevaluated, there are no metastasis, we'll consider either resection or radiation of the remaining lesion. He only has one in his lung. And then we need to also incorporate, in my opinion, Tarceva into his therapy later.
Why wouldn't you just skip the chemo and go right to erlotinib?
Again, one could. He's relatively healthy. He's only 52. And it's my bias that he has a lot of other micrometastatic disease. And again, it wouldn't be wrong. And if he had any other major comorbidities, I believe you could make a major argument to go straight to erlotinib.
I mean, and I don't know, maybe you're not that persuaded by the IPAS study, but there it seemed like people with mutations did better if they start on erlotinib.
Yes, I was impressed with that, but I'm not sure that the overall survival's any different because I don't know that that study looked at crossovers in adequate numbers. And it's my belief, as long as the patient receives erlotinib, I don't have any strong data yet. There's none out there. Whether they should receive it first or second. And rarely does a patient not get a chance to get second line or erlotinib.
How about your third case, a 65-year-old man?
Yes, he's a little older, but never smoked. He's out of ways and had liver metastasis. And we weren't sure what the histology was. The pathologist simply said they weren't sure. And we did multiple immunohistochemical staining. He had a KRAS, which was wild type, and his EML4-ALK fusion gene was done. It just came back the other day, and it wasn't present. And he's not mutated for the epidermal growth factor receptor either. So his major problem is, does he have a non-squamous cancer? And how do we determine this if a pathologist has done all the immunohistochemical staining? And I think there is a way now that looks pretty accurate, and that is by molecular profiling, and his is pending at this time, which can tell us most of the time whether we're dealing with an adeno large cell or a squamous. And as we know, the therapy varies, so this is an important determination.
You know, I guess that kind of leads into the whole issue of molecular profiling and carcinoma of unknown primary. And I know you were part of a presentation at ASCO that looked at that as a phase two study. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it will likely make a difference in treating patients with unknown primary cancer if indeed we can estimate or have a good idea of what the occult primary is. Most of these patients, in fact, do have a small, clinically undetectable primary site. And I believe, and a few others working with me, there's some contention about this, that if they have an occult colorectal cancer, then they'll respond like colorectal cancer when we know they have a colorectal cancer, et cetera, breast, lung. And molecular profiling can, in fact, identify a putative primary site in about 90 to 95% of these patients. This phase two prospective study was based upon this fact and the fact that we could then treat patients according to what the molecular profile diagnosed, knowing full well that this is still an experimental approach. And we had over 100 patients, but only 60-some were we able to get the profile on for various reasons and treated those with site-directed therapy based upon the molecular profile. And these are preliminary results, but It looks interesting. The responses seen in the small subsets that we had look similar to what you would expect in known cancers of that variety. And we're particularly enthusiastic about, although we need more patients, the colorectal subset, which showed no patient with progressive disease given colorectal site-specific therapy, 3 documented partial responses, and 5 other patients, 4 of who, if you did a waterfall plot, had evidence of tumor shrinkage, but not at the PR point and the last patient stable. So we believe that this type of approach may change the way we treat patients with unknown primary cancer.
Now, this is an RT-PCR assay?
Yes, it is. The one that was used in this prospective trial was a Biotheranostics RT-PCR assay requiring very small amounts of tissue and paraffin.
And I assume a physician in practice can order this? And what is it called, the profile that you actually order?
This particular profile is called Cancer Type ID. There are others. This is the Biotheranostics RT-PCR. Prometheus has one as well, which, again, these are looking at a molecular profile to look at the cancer type. It's not looking at individual targets within the cancer cells, but more the global cancer type. PathWorks also has one. There are 3 commercially available assays. PathWorks is a microarray. The other 2 are RT-PCR assays.
And what specifically are they looking at? Are there any genes that sort of intuitively make sense?
They're looking at normal cellular genes that are retained by neoplasms when the neoplastic transformation occurs. Essentially, this is the same immunohistochemistry. It looks at proteins, which, again, are normal cellular proteins. So these are not cancer-specific at all, but they're specific to the lineage that the cancer came from, which, in fact, is a way of identifying the cancer.
So, for example, what is it that they see that makes you think it's colorectal cancer? What kind of gene?
Well, for example, a gene that codes for this protein in the mucosa, CDX2, which we can also stain the protein with a stain for CDX2. There are several others, but that's one example that they're looking at. And the way they do this, there are libraries of known tumors, known colorectal cancer, known lung cancer, and then these assays are compared to those known cancers. And statistics are done on that, and algorithms are set up that they can then predict what the cancer is based on the similarity to a known cancer.
Anything else that's come out in any new research in terms of cancer of unknown primary that you want to comment on?
Well, I think it's important to bring up the fact that we already have identified a colorectal profile by immunohistochemistry. CK7 negative, that's cytokeratin, cytokeratin 20 positive, and CDX2 positive. That group of patients, particularly with liver metastasis or peritoneal metastasis, appears to respond in equivalent fashion to site-specific drugs like FOLFOX and Avastin, just like advanced colorectal response. So median survival is approaching 20 months versus, you know, unknown primary overall median survival's 8 or 9 months. So that's an important subset. And I think we're on the cusp of learning a lot more subset site-specific treatment based not only on immunohistochemistry, but also on molecular profiling.
Have you learned anything more in terms of sort of the biology of what's going on with these tumors and why it is that the primary seems to be occult?
Yes. There's a lot of genetic testing ongoing to try to determine if there's a specific fingerprint, if you will, of these occult cancers versus the overt known cancers. So far, no one's been able to find any specific unique feature. I'm certain that there's going to be some genetic change in how the primary tumor grows and metastasizes that will eventually be found in these patients, but I'm not sure that'll make a difference in the treatment responsiveness, whether they have those genetic features or not. But it may explain why they're an occult primary.